Ahead of tonight's State of the Union, we ask our Illinois delegation what they make of the current state of the country.
I just think there's a new kind of an uptick in optimism on the economy. On other issues like immigration, it's been a tough go.
That's Congressman John Shimkus. Representative Jan Schakowsky, who's boycotting the speech, also joins us. Plus, for years, an SIU professor was engaging in potentially illegal and unethical herpes vaccine testing on human patients without their informed consent.
SIU is fully and completely investigating what went on.
That's the SIU School of Medicine Dean and Provost Jerry Cruz speaking to the State Journal Register. The reporter who uncovered details about this research joins us, and the future of a historic old home in southern Illinois where free black people were kidnapped and sold back into slavery. It's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Tonight, President Donald Trump delivers his first State of the Union address. Just a reminder, we'll be carrying that speech live via NPR. It starts at 8 p.m. State of the Unions are traditionally a time for the president to address not just Congress, but the Supreme Court and all of the executive branch and the country. Tonight, though, the chamber won't be entirely full. 11 House Democrats say they're boycotting President Trump's State of the Union address. Three of them are from Illinois. We'll speak with one, Jan Schakowsky, in a minute. But first, yesterday afternoon, I had a chance to catch up with a Republican member of our Illinois delegation. Representative John Shimkus represents a wide swath of southern and central Illinois, part or all of 33 counties. Congressman, welcome back to the 21st.
I'm happy to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Let me ask, I think we always, or presidents always start the State of the Union address by talking about what they think the State of the Union is. What do you think the State of our Union is right now?
Well, it depends on how you, from what your perspective. First of all, I think that economically, I think the State of the Union is getting stronger. I'm a big believer that what we did on tax reform was very beneficial to individuals and also not just from their own tax return, but also on job creation and reinvestment and capital and higher wages. And that proof is in the pudding, along with easing regulatory burden. I just think there's a new kind of an uptick in optimism on the economy. On other issues like immigration, it's been a tough go. I mean, we're still struggling with how to provide some certainty to the DACA young adults while complying with some of the requests of reforming the immigration system like chain migration and the lottery system, along with the president's request for a wall. So that's, you know, that's, I think we're struggling on trying to find, you know, a unified position on how to address this immigration issue. If we go to infrastructure, which I think he'll talk about, I think people aren't pleased with where we're at in infrastructure, so they want us to get on board with a plan, and hopefully the president will lay out something on infrastructure and how we pay for strengthening our roads and bridges and our locks and dams and the like that. So, and it's a very dangerous world, so I think there's still uncertainty about our threats, North Korea and Iran, but also the fact that we've got men and women in harm's way and equipment, and with our budget fights that we've been having, the people that have been harmed the most are men and women in uniform, and you see that in equipment failures, and you see that in stress and strain on the force. So, you know, there are some things that are good, and there's some things that we still have questions on.
Representative Shimkus, you mentioned immigration. We've seen already some reports about the discussions that the president will be having about his immigration plan, which includes a path to citizenship for 1.8 million people who were covered, as you mentioned, under DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. It would also include $25 billion for a border wall, cuts in family immigration visas. Would you support a bill that includes all of these proposals?
We have a bill in the House that's very similar. I think that where people are tripping over the words of citizenship, pathway to citizenship, I think that the discussions, and again, these are discussions between the executive branch and some senators. I think the House has its own bill. I think that we'd definitely support an issue of legal status. And the question is, the people who came here illegally, do they get citizenship, or is there a delayed system by getting in the back of the line, which would be fair to the people who are working through the citizenship process now. So, you know, the devil's always in the details. The House plan will probably be different than the Senate. We've got to get our own act together between the two chambers and then negotiate with the president. So let's see what shakes out in this process.
President Trump was also just at the World Economic Forum in Davos. He's talked in the past about overhauling international trade, pulling out of agreements like NAFTA. What are you hoping to hear from the president on trade?
Yeah, I talk about trade quite a bit, too, because trade is very important for my agriculture community. We need markets so my corn and beans and my beef and my pork can get to places that want to buy that. On the other flip side is that there are countries that that subsidize their manufacturing, and that's where you get the words free and fair. We want to have free and fair competition. So if there's a – I mean, the federal government just took action against Chinese solar panel builders because the Chinese government subsidizes the production of those goods. That's not fair trade. So how do you manage to get in the manufacturing system the fairness without putting so much pressure on these countries that they start retaliating through the ag sector? So I'm one who's saying it's not an easy process, but I think that's the needle they're trying to thread.
Representative, three of your Democratic colleagues in the House are planning to boycott the State of the Union. One of them, Representative Bobby Rush, said, and I'm going to quote here, quote, "This is a presidency that has been built on racism, stupidity, and lies, which has already wasted enough of America's time, and I will not waste any more of mine," end quote. I wonder, as a fellow representative from Illinois, what's your response to that and to others who, of your other lawmakers who are boycotting the speech?
Well, I always make it my job not to comment on other members' votes or their statement. I just don't get drawn into that. Their statements speak for themselves. They have to be responsible to the citizens who send them there. I think it's you're there representing the people of your district. That's why I always go. I'm not always pleased when I'm there, but you know, I'm not going to be drawn into making a statement on a colleague's position and put words in their mouth. They can do that themselves.
Members of Congress usually bring a guest to the State of the Union. Senator Dick Durbin's bringing, actually, you mentioned DACA. I believe he's bringing a medical student who's supposed to be, I think, the first MD, PhD DACA student at Loyola's medical school. One of your Republican colleagues, Adam Kinzinger, is bringing Rockford area business owner, Patty Thayer. Who are you taking to the State of the Union?
So I've been a member, as many people know, for 20 years. I can think of a lot of people who've sacrificed to allow me to do this job for the people that I love to represent. But no one sacrifices more than family. So I am proud to bring my 18-year-old son to be my guest, who is going to get a chance to visit with other members of Congress, and it's a way that I can thank him for being a young, wonderful young man and has been able to get to 18 years old, even though he's had an absent father much of that time.
Representative John Shimkus is a Republican. He represents Illinois' 15th congressional district, a big part of southern and central Illinois, part or all of 33 counties. Representative Shimkus, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Right now, 11 House Democrats have said they will be boycotting tonight's speech. Three of them are from Illinois. I'm joined now by one of them. Congressman Jan Schakowsky represents Illinois' 9th congressional district. It covers parts of Chicago's north side and northern suburbs and also stretches northwest to include Des Plaines and Arlington Heights. Representative, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you so much.
You didn't attend the inauguration of President Trump, and now you're not going to his State of the Union speech. You've been in Congress since 1999. Have you ever not attended either of these events before?
I have never not attended. I was there through all of the Bush years, for example, and I didn't agree with him on many things. But he was the president of the United States. I felt that I should show up and that he deserved that respect. I don't feel that way with Donald Trump. I think that he has subjected the American people to a year of racist and erratic and divisive behavior and speech. And I refuse to accept that as the new normal.
I wonder how your colleagues, like, did you have a discussion with other colleagues who said they weren't going? Is this something that people have talked about among the Democratic Party in the House?
No, I decided on my own early last week that I wasn't going to attend. I didn't proselytize among my colleagues. This is a personal decision where I felt that I could not normalize a president who has been, you know, millions and millions of Americans have been disrespected by this president. He has flirted with nuclear Holocaust. He has been anti-immigrant from the first day of his campaign. He has demonized the young people, the dreamers, done everything to help the richest Americans at the detriment of ordinary people. So for all those reasons, I just felt like, no, I'm not going to go and stand up as he walks through that center aisle, glad-handing and patting on the back and walking to the podium and telling us what a great job he's been doing.
I saw that you tweeted that this is something that your constituents want. What have you heard from folks in your district about how they're feeling about the president?
Well, it's been interesting because the minute I announced that I was not going to be going, I have gotten tremendous response thanking me. Perfect strangers walking up to me at the grocery store or on the street and saying, yes, thank you for not going. And I had received some calls in anticipation of the State of the Union, asking me please not to go. So far, I have really not heard any pushback from people who say that I owe it to the president and to our country to go there. It's been quite the opposite.
Representative Schakowsky, I was just speaking with your Republican colleague, John Shimkus, about the fact that President Trump will likely discuss immigration this evening with reports that his plan includes a path to citizenship for the 1.8 million people who were covered. You mentioned DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. There are reports that it would also include $25 billion for a border wall and cuts in family immigration visas. Would you support a bill that includes all of these proposals?
You know, this is like throwing a crumb to, not that the dreamers are crumbs, but throwing one item to the dreamers, and then like a five-course meal to reduce immigration on the other hand. I'm a first-generation American, and my parents and grandparents never would have made it under the merit system that the president wants to instate now. This is people who can speak English, who have money in their pocket, who have a great education. My grandparents had none of those when they came here. And yet, because my grandfather was able to go through the alleys of Chicago selling fruits and vegetables on a horse-driven wagon, four children went to college, and his granddaughter is now a member of the United States Congress. And and many countries that are eligible for visas now would not be. And you know what he called those countries. I'm not going to repeat it on the air. But calling names of people who aspire to be Americans, it's just wrong. It's immoral. And so his plan for immigration is to cut by 50% legal immigration to this country. And believe me, that will take a toll on our economy because we are built on immigrants and their ambitions.
And so that said, Congresswoman, how do you intend to work with your Republican counterparts in the House to reach a deal on this? There's a deadline for March for DACA. How do you anticipate working together on this?
I hope we can work together on this, that we will agree to address what's in front of us right now, which is the question of the dreamers, the young people who came with their parents, with no decision of their own. And I just met with four of them. One of them works for the City Colleges of Chicago. Another just established a auto repair shop in my hometown. Two others are college students that want to be extremely productive and contribute to our society. So these are the wrong people to pick on. Let's get that done first. we can have a longer conversation about border security and about the rest of the immigration policy. But I'm hoping that by by February 8th, actually, the next deadline, that we can come up with an agreement about these young Dreamers and pass the Dream Act.
And so do you think that you would support something regarding DACA? Republicans are saying it has to also include funding for the wall. Is that something you would support?
You know, we can support some things on border security, but I'd be surprised if the Republicans are interested in spending that kind of money on a useless concrete, whatever they make it out of, wall. I wouldn't object to, though I don't think we need more border security, because immigration into the United States has not been a problem of late. We do have a lot of border security right now, but I would be willing to make that kind of trade. But if we're talking about spending tens of billions of dollars unnecessarily, because the President of the United States made this ridiculous promise, and of course it included that Mexico would pay for it, I would hope we don't have to do that. But, you know, I'm willing to look at a compromise, but it cannot include those really repressive other immigration issues. No.
Representative Jan Schakowsky is a Democrat for Illinois' 9th Congressional District, parts of Chicago's north side and the northern suburbs, as well as the northwest part of Chicago suburbs as well. Representative Schakowsky, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. By the way, have you ever wondered why our show is called the 21st? It's because Illinois is the 21st state. And as we celebrate our 200th anniversary this year, we are going to be delving into Illinois history at various points. If you have a suggestion, by the way, for something you'd love for us to look into, you can always email us. Our address is talk@21stshow.org. Today, back in 1838, a white man named John Crenshaw had a house built in southern Illinois, just 20 miles from the Kentucky border. He called it Hickory Hill, but locals began calling it the Crenshaw House, or the Old Slave House. Illinois was officially a free state back then, but the state still allowed for indentured servitude with contracts that lasted for decades. And, as I mentioned, with the slave state of Kentucky just 20 miles away, Crenshaw was believed to have kidnapped free black men and women and sold them into slavery. It's just one piece of Illinois history. The National Park Service has identified it as a historic station on what's known as the Reverse Underground Railroad. But no one's sure what will happen to the Old Slave House now, even though it's owned by the state of Illinois. Molly Parker is a reporter with the Southern Illinoisan. She's been looking into this. Mark Wagner is the director of SIU Center for Archaeological Investigations. Both of you, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Hi, glad to be here.
Mark, this house is one of the few from that time that's still standing, and we're going to get to that in a minute. But I want to ask you, we always hear about Illinois' role in the Underground Railroad. What was the Reverse Underground Railroad?
Well, the Reverse Underground Railroad is really, it reflects a period of lawlessness in southeastern Illinois. And it also has to do with a lot of conflicting laws regarding slavery. People living in that area continued to operate even after slavery became illegal in 1825. If you look at the censuses, you'll see African American people recorded as slaves as late as 1840. But what also happens is that because of the proximity to Kentucky, actually that house is only 10 miles away from Kentucky, is that you have groups of slave hunters are entering into southern Illinois. And in some cases, they're in pursuit of runaways. In some cases, they're actually just looking for any free African-American that they can get away with and take back into slavery. And one thing that happens is after the passage of the Fugitive Slave Act in the 1850s, people in areas like Illinois are required by law to assist slave catchers who are in pursuit of runaways. So men can enter into southern Illinois and say they're in pursuit of runaways, and if you don't help them, it's a violation of the law.
Molly, what inspired you to first look into this? The Southern did a whole series on this house.
It's always been a interest to me. I toured that house in early 2000s with Senator Paul Simon. The late Senator Paul Simon took his honors class there. And even though I grew up in Southern Illinois in the lower sort of Ohio River Valley counties, I didn't know about the house as a child growing up. So I was very fascinated that that existed just about an hour from where I grew up. And I remember him taking us there on a bus. I can't remember all the particulars. I don't think it was open to the public even by that point. But Senator Simon may have known the owners, and I know he had taken a couple of classes through there. And at the time, it was still set up like it had been when the, I think it was the Sisk family, Mark can correct me, that owned it as somewhat of a tourist attraction, which, you know, we've later learned may not have been exactly historically accurate, but it was still very chilling to see and to learn about. And so I was still just very much a young person back then, and coming back to the Southern, I wanted to know more. And I also was curious, you know, the state bought it. They paid $500,000 for it. What are we going to do with it? How long can it just sit there? And then, of course, SIU had put out a press release with Mark Schwartz talking about the fascinating research they had done there. So it was right for a revisit.
We'll get to the state part of this in a minute, Molly, and I want to ask you about that. But, Mark, let's go back to John Crenshaw. There's an interesting part of Illinois history of him being a salt baron. And can you explain how he took advantage of a loophole in Illinois law that still allowed for slavery?
Yes. That area down in Gallatin County had a major salt works or salt saline. And as early as 1803, the federal government protected that by establishing a 10,000-acre reservation around it, where they forbid settlement. And then they would lease out the salines to various people who would try to make salt. And early on, it was a very important place for making salt. And Crenshaw was one of the men who would get a lease from the federal government and then later the state government and try to make salt down there. But what happens is through time, they cannot compete with salt works in slave states. And so when slavery becomes illegal in Illinois in 1818, an exemption is carved out for Gallatin County and that area around the salines where slavery is permitted to continue on until 1825, because they make the argument we can't make salt using free labor because it's a very awful, arduous task to make salt with all these boiling kettles. And even after it became illegal in 1825, the salt makers down there, and Crenshaw was one of them, continued to lease slaves from Kentucky, even though that was illegal. And they continued to do that sort of thing up until the 1830s. But what happened is through time, because of the fact that they couldn't compete with the slave states, that salt making became more and more unprofitable. But Crenshaw continued to try and make a living at it. He was involved in a number of other projects also. But through time, his use of slaves and attempts to make salt just were diminishing returns every time he tried to do it.
And Molly, John Crenshaw died in 1871. The house was bought by the Sisk family in 1913. And then you mentioned this when you were going through the house as a kid. I should note to our audience, it's not open to the public now. I think it's been closed since the mid-90s. But something during the 20th century, the owners turned it into kind of a tourist attraction. Can you explain that, Molly?
Yeah, and when I was there with Senator Simon, I was, a sophomore or a junior at Southern Illinois University, and it was still set up like that, even though it was, I guess, no longer open for the touring public. I remember that because it was so startling. You would go up into the third floor, and they had what I didn't really know at the time, but through Mark's education, you know, I learned were basically props about the way it was set up in there. It looked like a prison up in a third floor attic, essentially, with these rooms with bars over it, ball and chain on the floor, a whipping post, which I don't think was even historically a whipping post. It was something from the yard that was used for something else, technically in history. And so, but you got the image that they had kept these slaves that they had captured on the third floor, and that was the story that we were told. And it sounds like, you know, the history that is actually unfolded there through the great research that's been done was certainly far more complex than that, and that probably, and I'll let Mark explain that, but it was interesting to me to learn that the way it was set up as a tourist attraction, which in some ways probably kept the house alive as far as, like, kept people coming through it, preserved its history, created some money for the family to keep for its upkeep, probably wasn't historically accurate, even though those things did happen there, even though it does appear that Crenshaw was involved in trading free Black people into the South. There are numerous stories about that and documentation about that, that perhaps the way it was set up, and those of us who have been through the house when it was set up like that have a, you know, it's a pretty shaking image, but it probably didn't transpire like that.
Yeah, Mark, what actually happened? As Molly's saying, it was sort of set up as a...
Well, one thing you have to remember is that paved roads first start coming into southern Illinois in the 1820s. And just like today, there are boosters who want tourists to come down here. And they've got to have places for them to go. And the stories about that house first start developing in the 1920s. And a lot of the stories are consciously being told by boosters. People will not come down to see the John Hart Crenshaw house. People will come down to see a haunted house. And people will come down to see an old slave house. And so these stories get exaggerated about, I mean, he is associated with slavery. He is not a nice man. But these stories get laid on that house and to have tourists come visit it. And that is the goal. And Molly is correct. It's a double-edged sword in the sense of the family that owned it, if they couldn't have made money off of it, it would have been destroyed years ago. There's about only one other site I know of associated with slavery in southern Illinois where the structure still stands. So, you know, if the family had not been able to make, you have to take the good with the bad and hopefully correct the interpretation of that house. But, yes, the things, the attic that is up there, as part of our research, we had a contract with the state of Illinois for 3 years to do archaeological, architectural, historic investigations into the site to give the state an accurate picture of what went on there. And the attic rooms that are upstairs are integral to the house. They were built when the house was built in the 1830s, but they were not intended to hold people in. The bars that are up there were added in the 1960s, as part of a tourist attraction.
In the 1960s, okay.
1960s, those iron bars, originally the attic rooms, they are very similar to what you would have seen on a steamboat of that period. What it looks like is that at that time, Crenshaw was involved in building a railroad for the state that ran directly below the house. And he apparently anticipated that he would get a lot of visitors in there. So he's building rooms in the attic for the use of visitors and maybe for family members. And they're different sizes. Some have windows. Some are very, very similar to what you would have seen on a steamboat of the period. So that's their original purpose, is for that reason. Now, at the same time, you can't ever say that he never held anyone up there in that attic. That's something you can't prove one way or the other. All you can say is that the story that he built those rooms to hold runaways or people he had kidnapped is not true. It doesn't mean he didn't do it at some point. But that's not why those rooms were built.
We just have about a minute or two left. Molly, the state of Illinois bought the house in 2000. What's the plan with this? Is there a plan for this Crenshaw house?
Last time I checked in with the Illinois Historic Preservation Agency, they said, you know, that we're in an era of tight budgets. They didn't answer me directly about whether it would ever open, but they said, you know, we're in the business of unfortunately shutting down and not opening things in the state of Illinois right now, and I think that's a shame. Even though it wasn't accurately portrayed under the Fisk family. I do think there are lessons to be learned there, and Marcus talked about that. You know, this could be an interpretive site to talk about not only the reverse Underground Railroad, but the efforts on the Underground Railroad, and to talk about slavery and the history of slavery in Illinois that it did exist, to talk about the long arm of that historical racism and how that affects today, where people live, how they live, tying in things like what's happening in Carroll, current day to the past. I think there's a lot of things that you could do there, but I don't. In the current state budget climate, I don't have much hope or nor been given indication that they plan to do anything anytime soon.
That's Molly Parker. She's a reporter with The Southern. We'll tweet out all of Molly's stories if you're interested in finding out more about this old slave house or the Crenshaw House. I want to thank Molly, as well as Mark Wagner. He's the director of SIU's Center for Archaeological Investigations, for giving us a little Illinois history lesson. Thank you, both of you.
Oh, happy
thank
to
you.
Do it.
Last week, SIU announced a second panel inquiry into herpes vaccine experiments by University Professor William Halford. Halford had injected people with an experimental herpes vaccine at a Springfield Holiday Inn Express and a Crown Plaza Hotel, also in Springfield, in 2013, before moving his operation to the Caribbean in 2016. That happened without the usual safety oversight from the FDA or institutional review boards. Some participants told Kaiser Health News, who uncovered all of this through its ongoing investigation into the professor's work, that they're now experiencing side effects. I should note that Professor Halford passed away in June before any of these revelations came to light. Marissa Taylor is with us on the line from Washington. She's a CNN correspondent and part of the Kaiser Health News Enterprise team that broke the first story, and continues to report on this. Dr. Erin Piquette is also on the line with us from Chicago, where she's an assistant professor of pediatrics at Northwestern University. She's also a lawyer whose work focuses on consent for healthcare research. A note to our audience, we did reach out to SIU Medical School to ask them to join this conversation. They declined. Marissa and Dr. Piquette, thank you for being here. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Marissa, let's just start.
Thanks for having me as well.
Yeah, Marissa, let's just start with you. We've just got a minute or two before we have to take a break, but I just wanted to ask you about the timeline of this. So there's two trials, one in 2013 and one in St. Kitts in 2016. When did the information about this come to light?
Came to light after Mr. Halford died in June, and that was when I started reporting on this and asking questions about his methods, and I went to the university after discovering that he did not have an institutional review board, which is a form of oversight.
And how was the research conducted, Marissa? Can you describe that for us?
Sure. According to documentation that I received in my reporting and his own emails, his own account, he initially injected herpes patients in hotel rooms without any oversight whatsoever. He was not a medical doctor. And after he did that, and he recruited people in what was described as sort of a secret process. After that, he took the experiments offshore and began injecting people with his experimental vaccine in a house in St. Kitts in the Caribbean.
Do we know how many people he injected with this experimental vaccine, Marissa?
We do not know exactly. I know that he injected as many as seven in his early hotel experiments, according to the emails, and then later 20 in St. Kitts. But there's evidence that there are potentially more people that he injected, and that we just don't know exactly how many.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Marissa Taylor from Kaiser Health News. Dr. Erin Piquette is going to be with us as well. Dr. Piquette, right after the break, I'm wondering if you can maybe describe for us how this is supposed to work. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're discussing the case of University Professor SIU, Professor William Halford. There's some reporting that Kaiser Health News has been doing for some time on him, reporting that he injected people with an experimental herpes vaccine in a couple hotel rooms in the Springfield area before he moved his operation to the Caribbean in 2016. The senior correspondent behind that is on the line with us from Washington now, Marissa Taylor. Dr. Erin Paquette is with us as well. She's an assistant professor of pediatrics at Northwestern University. She's a lawyer. Her work focuses on consent for healthcare research. Dr. Paquette, Marissa was just sort of describing to us how this took place, what her reporting showed. How is it supposed to work? What is the usual safety oversight from an institutional board or the FDA supposed to look like when you're dealing with humans and vaccines?
Sure. So any research study, whether it is a vaccine or a new drug or device that is being studied, is supposed to be reviewed by an independent body, either within the institution or an equivalent body, to ensure that the research is safe and that it meets federal regulations, so federal law for research safety for human subjects. So normally it goes to the IRB. The IRB reviews the research itself to ensure that it's safe to do in humans, reviews the risks of the research, the process by which the investigator or the researcher will get consent from the individual participants who will be participating, and also reviews the plan in the research study for tracking safety to participants across the study, how that will be monitored, ensuring that there's adequate protection of privacy and confidentiality of research participants, and that there's nothing that it coerces or creates undue influence in individuals' decisions to participate in research.
So in Marissa's reporting, Marissa, you describe emails Professor Halford sent some of the participants in which he described some of his methods and the dosing. Marissa, can you tell us a little bit more about those emails where he also invited participants out to drinks and dinner with him?
Sure. They were recruited through a Facebook account that allowed them to get information about the experiments, and they were invited to the hotel rooms by Mr. Halford. And before they were injected, he invited them for dinner. And in fact, they went to dinner with him. And these are people who have very serious herpes, many of them, which can be a very painful and chronic condition, and they felt very grateful to him and took him to dinner and socialized with him, which is rather unusual in these kinds of trials for the vaccine creator to be have that kind of contact with the very participants he is injecting.
Dr. Paquette, are there, I wonder how common it is for researchers to communicate directly and what regulations there are about the kind of contact researchers have with participants in studies?
So it is possible for a researcher to both be in contact with the participants separate from the research study and in the research study. In much of clinical research, participants are recruited from contacts with their treating physicians. However, one of the jobs of the IRB and the research team generally is to ensure that the level of influence that that person has based on their relationship with the participant isn't such that it could unduly influence the person's decision to participate voluntarily. And that's one of the things that the IRB looks at, is what are the recruitment strategies for a particular study. Certainly, I think it would be out of the realm of the ordinary to have a degree of social engagement with research participants related to their recruitment into a study.
Dr. Paquette, are there things that Professor Halford did that would be considered illegal versus just ones that could be argued to be unethical based on the reporting that you've seen?
I think based on the reporting that I've seen, the FDA does have strict regulations around the administration of unapproved drugs within the United States. And so that would be something that if found to be true, might be illegal, as well as the transport of such drugs from the United States across internationally to any site. It is not illegal to conduct research internationally that is not done through a U.S. institutional review board, but the FDA follows similar guidelines in reviewing any medications, vaccines, or products that will later come for FDA approval, that their regulations require that those have similar research ethics oversight. So it doesn't have to be a traditional United States institutional review board, but still needs to be managed by an independent oversight group.
Marissa, what ended up happening to the patients who were injected with, is a vaccine the right word for what we should be using to describe what he injected people with?
Sure. It was a vaccine that he created that out of a live but attenuated or weakened version of the virus. And it is unclear what happened to everyone. Some people I spoke with say they are still experiencing symptoms that they see as potential side effects, but others are worried because they actually have hope that this vaccine could work, and they would like to continue receiving booster shots, which they were offered before Mr. Halford's death. And now they would like to see the vaccine research continue, and so there's a lot of mixed feelings about this.
And what has been the response from Marissa? I mentioned at the beginning of this that SIU has announced a second panel inquiry into this. We did actually just get a statement from SIU, a very, very lengthy statement about this, pointing out that the university had been contacted by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, saying that many questions remain about Dr. Halford's research to find a cure for herpes. Before we get into what the university said, can you explain a little bit about what before his death and his role at the university, and if this is something that was discussed a lot, that he was trying to find a cure for herpes?
Sure. This was something that before he went offshore to the Caribbean, he wrote an account himself describing how when he found out that he had cancer, that he realized that he might not have enough time to have FDA oversight. And he then determined, according to his own account, to try to do human subject research. And part of that was going to the Caribbean. The university said initially when I talked to them that they did not know exactly what his methods were, that they didn't have any responsibility in ensuring that he followed any FDA oversight or IRB oversight, because they said he created an independent company. And as a result, they just figured that he was following the proper protocol and that they had no responsibility to these human subjects, to the actual people who had herpes he was injecting with his vaccine. After I wrote a story, the HHS, Health and Human Services, then asked them how they were not violating a pledge that they had made, the university itself had made, to follow such protocols with all research, even if it's privately funded, like this research had been funded.
And so I should point out that the statement that the university just sent us about 15 minutes ago says that many questions remain about his research. Their investigation has found that his breach of ethics occurred before and after his independent research company, Rational Vaccines, was formed. They said, "We believe he was intentionally hiding his activities from the university's leadership, faculty, research, and others." They said their investigations have found that he did inject individuals while he was a faculty member. This is from Dean and Provost Dr. Jerry Cruz. He wrote, "As doctors, we have an obligation to protect our human research subjects. I take this role very seriously. As a dean, I deeply regret the actions of Dr. Halford. He behaved in a way that is contrary to our mission, values, and expectations. As a dean, I am disappointed, upset, and even angry that the university, the research community, and I were misled by Dr. Halford." Dr. Paquette, I wonder if I can ask you, as a professor at a medical school, is it possible that no one at SIU knew about what was going on? Can doctors kind of just do research, or in this case, he's not a doctor, but can professors or other people do? Do you think that's possible for people to do research sort of on the side and people not be aware of it?
I think it's possible. I don't know what the extent of interaction with the research facilities at SIU Dr. Halford had. I did read in some of the reports that there was a patent at some point out there for related to this vaccine. I don't know whether that was related to human subjects research or the research that would involve people, or if it was related to work that was in preparation for those kinds of studies. So I think it's possible, but in an institution where you do have this pledge, it's called a federal-wide assurance, where you can you have to follow these regulations for any federally funded research, but you can extend that to institutions can voluntarily extend that to all research that happens at their institution. Institutions then do have a responsibility to know what's going on at their institution, but that can be limited if people are not straightforward with the institution about what they're doing. I think there's still an ongoing investigation into what level of awareness there was and what level of engagement, because what qualifies you as falling under this pledge is whether the institution was engaged in the research, which includes their employees being engaged in the research, but they have to have knowledge of that for that to apply. And so I think that is certainly an area that needs further investigation. I can't speak, to this particular circumstance. I think in somebody that wants to hold that information back, it's possible, but certainly given what's out there and this knowledge of at least an existing patent, I don't know what that investigation will show in terms of awareness.
And Marissa, what's happened so far with the investigation? I mentioned Health and Human Services. Can you just sort of update us on who's looking into what right now at SIU?
Sure. There was an initial look at by the Institutional Review Board of the university whether there should be an investigation into his conduct when it comes to his research. They said there should be. They found that there was evidence that there was misconduct, and now there's a broader investigation going on. It strikes me that the university is saying right now that he misled the university before the end of the investigation. As far as I've been told, the investigation is still ongoing. And in the emails that I wrote about, there was evidence that he was using university resources. He was relying on graduate students, on research assistants. He was using his lab, his emails, his university emails, his university phone. So I think that outside experts on research and how universities are involved question whether, if the university didn't know, whether they should have known.
We've got a little audio that our producers found online that I wanted to play. It's a video of that they found at Vimeo of Professor Halford before his death, defending his research.
The number of people manufacturing biologics in the 60s was probably 10 to 100-fold greater than the number doing it today. And the reason why is because nobody could afford to get past this regulatory hurdle. And what they did is create $50 to $100 million of paperwork for anyone to even test a new biologic in a single patient.
Dr. Paquette, what about that argument that the laws are too stringent and inhibit research?
I think that there is a careful balance between inhibiting research and allowing research to progress, but also protecting human subjects. So even in the last year, the FDA has and consistently reexamines policies about what level of evidence and what type of evidence is needed to support a new vaccine or other medical drug or device to come to market to try to put that balance in the right place. But while I recognize there are some may view those laws as barriers. I think that it's important to understand the history behind regulation for human subjects research and to know that they're really there to protect people from exactly the kinds of scenarios that some of these participants find themselves in, where there may be adverse effects that potentially weren't followed because of inappropriate monitoring, where there might not have been adequate consent for participation.
Yeah, it sounds like, there's lots of issues here, and I'm afraid we're out of time, but I want to thank Dr. Erin Paquette from Northwestern for joining us. Marissa Taylor will tweet out all of the information. We'll have the full statement at our website at 21stshow.org. That's up. Does it for us today. Thanks for tuning in.